further ado, we welcome Dr. Karen Shawn.
Thank you, Rabbi, for the beautiful introduction. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you. I have to say that it's a very difficult act to follow. I wish I had come earlier so I could have gone first. But at the same time, it's a very nice tie-in. Because what the rabbi talked about today was, for me, new. Until I was a grown woman, I didn't know these stories. I knew about the Holocaust. But it wasn't until I actually began my studies at Yad Vashem that I learned about the Gedolim and the Rabbanim, who did the kinds of heroic deeds that the rabbi talked about. And why is that? First of all, because when I was a child, there was no such thing as learning about the Holocaust. In my school, in my synagogue, in my home, my grandparents were here since the first moments of the 1900s. I didn't know about the Holocaust. It wasn't something that was discussed. I didn't come from Washington Heights, so I didn't know survivors. I grew up in upstate New York. I never saw a number on an arm. It wasn't a part of my growing up. My parents believed that children should be children as long as they can be, that people should not know about such things until they're adults. And so it wasn't until I was an adult that I learned. But even then, when I learned about the Holocaust, I learned what historian Itzhak Mays calls the Nazi story. You may be familiar with Itzhak Mays. He did the Skokie Museum. And he talks about the fact that people like me, most of America, and perhaps even you, learn the story of what the Nazis did to the Jews. They don't learn the story of what the Jews did. Now, I was an English teacher by profession. And as an English teacher, the history part sort of went by me. I didn't really get the big picture. I kept saying, as I learned about the battles and the wars and the times and the things that went on, I kept saying, but what did the mother say to the child? How did the Jews live every day? What did the father say when the girl had to go out and get food? What is the upside-down world of the Holocaust saying to me? Where do I learn that? And then when I did begin to learn the stories of these people, I still said, but what about the people like me? What would I have been able to do not being a rabbi, not being a scholar, not being a hero? And so I began to devote my studies to the Jewish story, the understanding of what happened to the everyday people during this time, to begin to understand that the Jews were not the passive victims that most young people in America are taught that they were, but that they were active agents who responded with a remarkably wide range of responses, a wide range of resourceful behaviors. And I want to talk today then about how the Jews resisted, defended themselves, and defied the Nazis. So I want to ask you, what comes to your mind when you think about the word resistance? It's a word sometimes that's overused in the subject and in general, but we have to get to the heart of what it means to say that Jews acted, that Jews resisted, that Jews defied the Nazis in every way they could. So is resistance just saying no? Is it refusing to do something that someone tells you to do? Is it fighting against an immoral rule or an immoral order? Is it gathering with thousands of others and protesting, as we see so many times today? People say they resist something that they don't like by gathering in the streets. And what about if you think about what resisting means when you think about the war, a war? Are we talking about bombs and guns? Well, the Holocaust was a war, but of course it was nothing like a fair fight between armies. It was a war between the highly trained German army and a completely unarmed, innocent, defenseless civilian population. It was a war against the Jews. This war against the Jews started, as you know, in Germany in 1933 with the rise of Hitler. But it became much worse after September 1st, 1939, when another separate war began, World War II.
when the German army marched into Poland and conquered it on its way to invading the rest of Europe. So when we consider Jewish actions in the context of this terrible time, we have to understand the conditions that the Jews faced when the Nazis invaded each country in which they lived. The invasion changed everyone's life immediately. A survivor named Dove Friedberg says this: "A German soldier with time to kill lines up 10 Jewish men with beards and shoots every third one like dolls at a carnival for sport, for fun. Father is dead. September 1st, the war just began, and for our family, the tragedy is full. Our father is dead." Survivor Yisrael Gutman, famous historian of Yad Vashem, explains what happened in the weeks immediately following that invasion. He says right away, after a week, Warsaw was a city under bombardment. A great part of the Jewish quarter was completely ruined. It was an absolute change, a shock, what happened during this month. This was a turning point in our lives. There was hunger. There was finding a space for people who lost their living places. There was what to do with the children. There were no schools, no shuls. It was forbidden to pray in public. It was forbidden to gather. There was no more press. There was no contact with the outside world. No contact with extended families. The hunger was terrible. There was the beginning of epidemics. Relationships began to suffer. There was a feeling that we Jews were in a kind of prison under unbelievable conditions. So that was the terror of the invasion. Now, if this is what is happening to people suddenly, shockingly, out of nowhere, in the middle of what had always been a good and comfortable life, what could they do? How did they respond? And the people who were so shocked and suffering, who were they? Well, a million were children and babies. At least another million were old and sick people, including old women and rabbis. How did they respond? We've heard about five today. How did the rest of them? Now, remember that the Jews at that time didn't understand the word Holocaust. They didn't understand what was happening to them. They had a different perception of what was happening to them because for them there was no Holocaust. Holocaust is our term. The Jews of Europe were not reacting to what we now know was a Holocaust, but to the reality that they saw at that time and with the information that they had at that time and within the framework of their historical experience. So as Hitler's armies invaded and occupied one country after another, when Jews in Warsaw heard that 500 Jews in the next town had been murdered, what did they call it? A pogrom. Well, we had survived pogroms. We understood how to respond to pogroms. So their response to that news was different from what it would have been had they known that Hitler meant to annihilate every single Jew. But they didn't know. They couldn't know because the concept of the Holocaust was, at that time, unfathomable. And yet, Jews acted decisively. Many resisting and defying the Nazis, each according to his or her own means and abilities. So let's examine the evolution of the Jewish response, understanding that we can't read history backwards, knowing as we do now what happened at the end. We have to examine it instead as if we're looking at a series of photographs, with each one illustrating the different but equally difficult situations in which the Jews found themselves. So from the beginning of World War II, when everyone looked for its quick end, the Jewish goal, understandably, was survival. How can we stay alive until the end of the war? Well, if the answer was to endure the hunger and the beatings and the torment, to do what the Germans ordered to avoid being murdered on the spot, then that was a form of defiance. Yet, many Jews soon became more active in their responses. They offered what historians call polemic resistance, which is exactly what we heard this morning. That is, keeping journals to record everything that happened in the ghettos so that ultimately the world would know what the murderers had done. They published underground newspapers. They established secret archives. Onan Shabbos, you might know from Rabbi Ringelblum. Others engaged in what we call symbolic or personal resistance. And that means attempts to preserve one's individual dignity, one's humanity, to preserve Jewish identity, continuity, values, language. For example, the Germans closed, as you heard in Israel Gottman's comments, they closed all Jewish schools. Education, in fact, was punishable by death. But within 6 months of the invasion, 180 religious schools served 2,000 students in Warsaw. Clearly, acts of defiance. There were soup kitchens and aid societies. People helped one another despite their own pain, their own need, their own hunger. Later, some attempted defensive resistance, which we'll talk about, aiding and protecting other Jews through organizing escapes for them, such as the French Jewish Scouts escape operations to neutral Spain and Switzerland, or attempts to produce forged identity documents, attempts to organize networks to hide Jews. Eventually, of course, there were those who engaged in offensive armed resistance. In short, there was no single response to a given situation, but rather a multitude of reactions intended to defy German plans to dehumanize Jews and destroy Judaism. At first, Jews worked on the quality of their survival and organized cultural events in the ghetto. That's what we talked about a minute ago, called symbolic resistance. So what did they do? They had Yiddish theater, they had children's choirs, they had an orchestra, they had libraries. These activities provided hours of comfort and were most assuredly acts of resistance. Some Jews kept traditions and celebrations as a form of defiance. A rabbi named Shimon Huberman recorded the day-to-day conditions in the Warsaw Ghetto. Listen to what he describes. On Purim in 1940, despite the fact that public prayer was forbidden, every courtyard in the Warsaw Ghetto had minyanim in which the Megillah was read. For Pesach, rabbis made the baker's ovens kosher for Pesach, and shmura matzah was baked from grain harvested last summer. Hanukkah parties were held in every courtyard in Warsaw and in other ghettos. One survivor, perhaps you know her name, famous woman who unfortunately just passed away, Vlad Kramin, she explained that to remain a human being in the ghetto, one had to live in constant defiance, to act illegally. We had illegal synagogues, illegal classes, illegal meetings, and illegal publications. A man named Chaim Kaplan wrote in his diary, "Everything is forbidden to us, but we do everything. There is even dancing, although the stomach is empty. It is even a mitzvah to dance. Every dance is a protest against our oppressors." And what about the children? Jewish children resisted as well. The Germans rationed food in the ghetto, as you know. They gave the Jews only enough to eat for 2 or 3 days a month. So hundreds of children between the ages of 4 and 14 became food smugglers, and they faced beatings or death if they were caught. And that's what I said earlier when we talk about the upside-down world of the Holocaust. This is a world where the children had to care for the parents because only a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old sometimes could be small enough to sneak out through a hole in the ghetto wall and manage to get some food to bring home. A survivor named Zenya Malachi from the Vilna ghetto remembers, "I had long, narrow pockets sewn into my clothes so I could smuggle in flour or peas. One time I was caught, and oh my God, I was beaten because I had some peas in my pocket." But still, the children smuggled. 13-year-old Jewish girls who looked Polish smuggled kosher meat along with kashrut certificates signed by the shopkeepers into the ghetto from nearby towns. These young smugglers became the ghetto's most important citizens, its heroes. Another way to look at Holocaust heroes. In the Radom ghetto, let me tell you a story about a man I actually know. He lives in Forest Hills, New York. His name is Bernard Gottfried. He tried to be a hero, too, by leaving the Radom ghetto, which was an act punishable by death. And why did he want to leave? Not to escape, but to get a chicken from a Polish farmer and smuggle it home, because he wanted his family to have meat for Rosh Hashanah. Well, the farmer gives him the chicken because the farmer had owed his parents money from before the war. But as he approaches the ghetto wall to return, the chicken begins to squawk. And Bernard, knowing his life is in danger if the guard discovers him and the chicken, strangles him. When he gives it to his mother, she hugs him and says, "I'm sorry to tell you that in spite of the risk you have taken to make this a better holiday, we can't eat an unkosher chicken." Can you imagine how he feels? "Does it really matter that the chicken isn't kosher?" he asks her. "Who will know? Won't God forgive us?" His mother is a different kind of hero, and she is unrelenting. "In wartime or in peacetime," she says, "we are a people who must abide by the laws, or else we'll cease to be a people." So let's review for a minute. Jews were not soldiers. They had no tradition of organized resistance. They had little or no access to weapons. Every Jew was hunted, targeted for placement in a ghetto or a camp. They would risk their lives and their families' lives if they tried to escape. And if they did escape, where would they go? Few had false identity papers, fewer still had guns, and fewer still had someone who would help them if they were outside. Very, very few non-Jews would help them to hide, even if they wanted to, because especially in Poland, the Poles would be killed along with their families if they were discovered to be hiding a Jew. So most just closed their doors. So successful escape was almost impossible. Instead, the Jews stayed where they were and resisted with whatever means they had. So for most, resistance was anything that gave hope or saved lives. And that may not be a distinction, that may not be a definition that you're used to or that you've heard. But the bottom line is, for Jews, at that time, resistance meant staying alive. But that began to change slowly. Young Jews, in particular, began to realize that they must resist not just the occupation, but the deportations. And in December 1941, in the Vilna ghetto, a young man named Abba Kovna, who was a leader of Hashomer HaTzair, begins to argue that this polemic and spiritual and religious resistance, those are important, but it's not enough, he said. He argues for physical resistance against the Nazis, and he declares rebellion and armed resistance are the only ways that honor our people. But his friends disagree. They remind him of the bitter reality of collective punishment, the German policy of killing many Jews for the actions of a few. And so they say, how can we even consider armed struggle when it is clear that by this act we may endanger all the Jews in the ghetto? We can't be sure that the Nazis plan to liquidate the ghetto in the immediate future. We are ready to risk our lives, but do we have the right to take action for which all the Jews will pay? These kinds of questions are crucial when we're teaching our children about this, because, of course, young people today, when they first learn about it, say, well, why didn't they just fight back? Why didn't they leave? Why didn't they kick them? That's what kids think. But it's so complex. It's so complicated. Do I have the right, they said, to kill a Nazi if more Nazis will come and kill 10 of my friends or my family? And yet, despite those consequences, some Jews did choose active resistance. In the Minsk ghetto, it was only 12 blocks long, 12 blocks wide. It held between 80 and 100,000 Jews. Its large resistance organization enabled some 10,000 Jews to escape and join Soviet partisan groups in the nearby forest. Mostly those were the people whose families had already been murdered. They had nothing left to lose, and so they managed to escape. And in the spring of 1942, the Bielski brothers, the men from the film Defiance, set up camps in the forest near Novigrad. The Jewish partisans, their group kills enemy soldiers and sabotages their operations. They protect Jewish men, women, and children who come to the forest seeking refuge. And a partisan, I think this is such an important quote, because again, we always have this dichotomy, especially with young people when they're learning about this, between the fighters or the rebellion and the regular people. And it's the fighters up here. These are the people that are the real heroes. That's what some young people think. But a partisan himself said, "When I was fighting with guns together with other partisans, this was not heroism. To keep Jews in the forest for 2 years and save them, this was heroism." And it's estimated that between 10 and 12,000 Jews survived the war in partisan family camps. Now, these young fighters were, for the most part, secular. Some religious Jews also fought. And as a matter of fact, although Rabbi Lau's father didn't actually fight, he was heard to say during a selection, "I don't know why we're standing here with our arms crossed. Even if we don't have weapons, we should attack them with our fingernails. I don't think this standing around can save any of us. We have nothing to lose by trying to fight them." But in the main, as we heard this morning, most religious Jews have their own ways of resisting. I know of a mother who starved herself to save a little bit of the food she had to pay the rabbi for bar mitzvah lessons for her son who would not survive his 13th birthday. These Jews continued to keep the mitzvot, as we heard. We heard about Rabbi Ashri in the Kovno ghetto. He interpreted halacha to help the people who, despite the drastic conditions, remained committed to following our laws. And what Rabbi Ashri said later, "One resists with a gun, another with his soul." So what do they ask? The questions are countless, and they're fascinating. A very big one was, what can we substitute for candles to light for Shabbat? Does a ghetto home need a mezuzah? At Pesach, there were questions. Hunger was stalking everyone, and yet they asked, can the black beans that are part of the ghetto food ration be eaten on Pesach? Who can worry about such things here? Some people may have asked, but these heroes committed to following Torah law did worry. And how do we know this? Because Rabbi Ashri recorded on paper that he tore from cement sacks both their questions and his answers. And he hid, as the other rabbi did, he hid the paper in tin cans that he buried around the ghetto for safekeeping. He and they survived, and we have them today. By 1943, more and more young people in particular accept the terrible truth that Hitler meant to murder every single Jew in Europe. Now they must resist because they understand that what they're resisting is mass murder. On January 18, 1943, the Nazis surround the Warsaw ghetto and seize workers for deportation. The Jewish Fighting Organization, led by a young man named Mordechai Analevich, puts out an emergency leaflet and the January Revolt begins. "Jews," he cries, "do not resign yourselves to death. Defend yourselves. Grab an axe, an iron bar, a knife. Let them take you in this way if they can." The young fighters suffer heavy losses in the 4-day battle, but they kill or wound 50 Germans. More importantly, they electrify the ghetto residents with their actions. So the 50,000 Jews who remain work in a frenzy to prepare for a ghetto-wide uprising. They plan it to begin when the Germans return for the final deportation. The 27th of Nisan, April 18th,
1943, 70 years ago, almost to the day. It was Erev Pesach. The fighters were ready.
And who were these fighters? The entire high command were teenagers. Zivia Lubetkin tells us, I was in the attic, and I saw thousands of Germans armed with machine guns surround a ghetto. And all of a sudden, they entered the ghetto, armed as if they were going to the front against Russia. Our unit numbered some 20 men and women, youngsters. What arms did we have? Each of us had a revolver and a grenade, and the whole squad had two guns and some homemade bombs, prepared in a very primitive fashion. We had to light them with matches. It was strange to see those 20 Jewish men and women standing up against a great armed enemy. Well, we knew they would defeat us, but we also knew that they would pay a high price for our lives. Amazingly, Jews resist German troops, tanks, and artillery fire, and, at least in the beginning, drive the Germans from the ghetto. And through it all, they remain both human and hopeful. Listen to this just-discovered diary entry of an unknown woman fighter. And that's another thing, by the way, that one of the things that makes this such a rich lifetime of study, such a fascinating lifetime of study, because we're still discovering and uncovering things that happen, people who have given testimony that we've never heard before, diaries that are only now coming to light, that have been put on shelves in museums, but because of a variety of reasons have only now been translated. And this I just found it less than 3 weeks ago. And this is what she says. Evening, Wednesday, April 28th, 1943. 10 days of fighting with our bloodthirsty enemy who intends to destroy us altogether. For the moment, the bombing and the shooting have stopped, and the danger lying in wait for us has turned in another direction. People are bathing, handing out coffee, cooking. Everything is being done in silence. We must survive. We hope we will survive. We are fighting for justice and the right to live. The uprising was crucial psychologically for the Jews, but it had no hope of real victory. The teens fought when there was nothing left to lose. They fought to achieve dignity in their inevitable death. On May 8th, 1943, the Germans attacked the command center at Mila 18. I'm sure many of you have read the book. Mordechai Anilevich was among the 20 fighters who fell there. By the end of the uprising, the fighters estimate that they have killed or wounded 1,000 Germans, but only 60 Jewish fighters are left to crawl through the sewers of Warsaw to the Aryan side. Those fighters, in case you don't know, lived to go to Israel. And when they came, the government said, you've been through such a terrible thing, we think that you should be separated and placed in different places around, different homes around the country. And the ghetto fighters said, no, 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 no. We will never be separated again. And they founded the ghetto fighters, kibbutz, Beit Lochamei Ghetto, in between Akko and Nahariya. And there they built the country's first museum, predates Yad Vashem. They built a Holocaust museum with the few remnants, the few fragments of artifacts that they were able to take with them. And that museum stands today in that space, and it's on the kibbutz. Several, maybe 15 years ago, they built an addition to the museum, and it's called Yad LeYalid, the only children's museum to the Holocaust. And when it was first proposed, people said, oh my God, what? Well, we can't have a Holocaust museum for children. Their understanding is our understanding now. Their understanding is, by children, they mean fourth grade, not 4 years old, fourth grade through ninth grade. And in that museum, which is a children's museum, their motto is up to the camps, but not inside. Their children's museum is chronological and takes people through the ghettos and understand, helping them to understand what happened before the ghettos, during the ghettos. And it ends with the gates of Auschwitz. It ends with railroad tracks, but you cannot see anything because they understand that that part of the Holocaust is only for adults. It's a really interesting model, and it's a model that most of us who teach elementary and middle school students have adopted. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising lasted longer than the Polish army's resistance to the German invasion in 1939. These young Jewish fighters were overwhelmed, but they resisted and they died with honor. So, that's resistance in the ghettos. But what could Jews do to resist the Nazis once they had been sent to work camps and transit camps and concentration camps? And by the way, the numbers are astounding. I don't know if you've seen the latest figures. There were 30,000 slave labor camps. There were 1,150 Jewish ghettos. There were 980 concentration camps. There were 6 death camps. There were thousands of other camps used for terrible things, including euthanizing the elderly and infirm or transporting victims to killing centers. In such places, all forms of defiance helped to keep the Jews alive. Sometimes it was simply believing that things would get better, refusing to give in to despair. Sometimes it was showing altruism, caring, and love in a loveless world. So hidden gestures, such as even a nod, a smile between and among prisoners, helped to boost morale, although they were forbidden, and their detection by the SS could result in a crippling beating. A survivor named Aharon Appelfeld, author, brilliant author, has said that man as a number is one of the horrors of dehumanization. The Nazis insisted that prisoners could be known only by their camp-assigned number. So simply whispering another person's given name was a morale aid. In Terezin, the so-called model camp, Jewish teachers organized classes in painting, poetry, theater, and music, and cared for the children as if they were their own. Sometimes resistance was praying. When prayer was forbidden, a survivor remembers, if caught, and many were, they were severely beaten, but this did not deter them. Prayer was the force that kept them alive and encouraged their will to survive. Could hope, altruism, prayer survive, even in the death camps? Yes, indeed, even in the death camps. There were Jews who resisted. Some gave away their one daily slice of bread, tearing it into small portions each morning and giving it out as tzedakah. Others, well, listen to this story from Josef Weiss, a young Jew from Slovakia. How can I forget the Pesach Seder that Itzi Mato led for us? He kept the Jewish calendar, I don't know how. He kept it all from memory. He knew when Rosh Chodesh would fall and whether it was one day or two at each fast day. We asked, how will we celebrate this Zman Charutena? We have plenty of bitter herbs, but of matzah, we don't have the minimal portion. And we have 4 cups, but not of wine, of blood and tears. So how did Matzah lead the Seder? With songs. He built an entire Seder around Hasidic Pesach melodies. All of the melodies were like victory marches. They were not tunes of tragedy, but of strength and encouragement. In the depth of Auschwitz, in Block 14, a Hasidic youth lay on a wooden bunk and sang Hasidic melodies of the Pesach Haggadah. One song after another, he reconstructed a spiritual Seder for a group of men, most of whom had preserved no trace of Jewish traditions in their day-to-day struggle for survival. This was a Seder with no food, no elegant clothes, but it had a profoundly spiritual nature that transcended even the horrors of Auschwitz. Still others chose to meet death with dignity by maintaining an unshakable faith. Rabbi Lau's father, for one. God can intervene even at the last moment. We must not lose faith or hope. God will rescue his people as he always has, just when everything seems to be lost. Ani ma'amin, they sang as they walked to the chambers of death. But others insisted, not Kiddush Hashem, not a martyr's death in the name of God, but Kiddush HaChayim. Hold on to life. We will stay alive as long as we can. The very act of living on became the main form of heroic defiance. And there was also physical resistance. There were uprisings, even in the death camps. In Treblinka, on August 2nd, 1943, Jews killed guards, and some 750 prisoners try to escape. About 100 succeed. In Sobibor, on October 14th, 1943, 300 of the 600 prisoners survived the escape that the Jews attempt, although only some 50 survived the war. And in Auschwitz, Jews worked together for months to plan an uprising and escape. Rosa Robota and three other young women steal explosives from the munitions factory where they work, and they smuggle them to the men in the unit called the Sonderkommando. On October 7th, 1944, the uprising begins. The men set one of the four crematoria on fire, blow it up, and run to the fences. Almost all fall in battle with the SS guards, but the attempt lifted the spirits and gave hope to the many thousands remaining in Auschwitz. Rosa, she and the other young women are caught, tortured, and publicly hanged on January 6, 1945, just days before Auschwitz is laid. This morning, I've talked about praying, hoping, writing, loving, teaching, learning, creating, helping, and fighting, all the ways that Jews who could defied the Nazis and resisted. So, finally, what did some survivors of the death camps do as soon as they were liberated? They held services. To give thanks to God? No, Elie Wiesel says. To tell him, listen, as mere mortals, as human beings, we can seize weapons and use them everywhere and on everyone who hurt us and never stop because it is our right. But we are Jews, and as such, we renounce that right. We choose, yes, we choose to remain human and generous. And that Jewish story is a most remarkable form of resistance. As I conclude this talk, I want to make clear that these stories, as important and wonderful as they are, do not challenge the significance of the grim fact of the murder of 6 million Jews. They do not imply that all Jews were heroic, that all resisted, or that defense and the defiance were the primary response of the majority of Jews in the Holocaust, no matter in which city or country they were. I do not share them with you to talk about the triumphant human spirit. I don't say that that, quote, triumphant spirit can mitigate the murderous actions of the Nazis, because it cannot. These stories don't serve as the happy ending to the Holocaust. There is no happy ending. The truths presented here are offered not as a way to make ourselves feel better, although they might, or to minimize or mitigate the impotence, the grief, the rage, the despair we all feel when we learn this story. I tell them to you because they are a necessary component of the historical record, which details the facts of Jewish action as well as the acts of the Nazis. We all know how the Jews died. These stories help you to understand and to remember how so many of them lived every day. The filmmaker Pierre Sauvage points out, if we remember solely the horror of the Holocaust, we will pass on no perspective from which meaningfully to confront and learn from that horror. If the hard and fast evidence of the possibility of good on earth is allowed to slip through our fingers and turn to dust, then future generations will have only dust to build on. This morning, then, you have heard some facts about the Jewish story, about the possibility of good, about the many and varied ways that countless Jews during the Holocaust, everyday people, women, children, old people, during the Holocaust took care of one another, preserved their identity, their language, their faith, their rich culture and heritage, defended themselves, and defied their oppressors. As you leave here, and I thank you for your attention, I hope that you will commit to continuing their mission to keep their voices alive by sharing what you've heard and by keeping in mind that the question to be asked is not why there was so little resistance, but how there was so much. Thank you.